The fascinating thing about conductors is, to me, how they not only endure, but they mature. And I don't think I've ever heard of a conductor that's gone the other way, starting and then working down to retirement and finishing in a sort of state of grace, but not actually being as good as they were when they started. It always sort of goes the other way, that particular arc. But in Richard Bonning's case, the proof, I think, is in those tremendous performances of La Sonnambula that we've had the pleasure to hear. Yes, indeed, indeed. And it struck me the other night that bel canto, an art form that's been in and out of vogue, principally because of the people who interpret it or the people who perform it, let alone the people who wrote it, vanishing and then coming back, all down probably to supply and demand more than anything else. But how bel canto, Richard, for you is at the heart of what you do, and I guess it's probably always been that. But I'd like you to just perhaps start off by talking about your sort of long relationship with that particular art form.
Oh, it all just happened, you know. I grew up with a family of singers. My aunt sang, my mother, my father sang, and in the 40s, for example, or even the 30s, there was no television. We all sat around the piano, or I sat at the piano, and they sang. And so I grew up being very used to the human voice. I did lots of concerts even before I left Australia in the 40s, some with Joan. And then later on, even in Australia, I found a score of Puritani very early on. And that I went crazy about because it's so like Chopin. If you play Bellini opera on the piano, it really sounds like Chopin, and who I was crazy about and still am. And it all went on from there. When I went to London, I got a scholarship in 1950 and Joan followed me in a year later. She was going to audition for Covent Garden, and I don't need to tell you she passed the audition. In fact, she had to do four auditions, and she passed the fourth one. Would you believe that? There were idiots around then. But we started working together, and I was very fascinated by 18th and early 19th century music. And so, of course, naturally, I got her singing it. At first, she wasn't too interested because, you know, she'd been brought up by her mother and her early teachers to believe that Wagner was God and Verdi was soon after, you know, which is all very well. And I mean, I think we all adored the music of Wagner when it was done properly. But to give a young girl these big Wagner roles was very stupid because it can harm the voice very much. But she was lucky. She was very strong. She had her doctor in London, who was a very old man when she went to him, had seen the chords of Tetrazzini and Melba, and he said that she had the strongest vocal cords he'd ever seen. So she was able to put up with my experimentation, and it was just that, really. And we played around with all the Mozart roles and bel canto roles and some early Verdi, and it was a wonderful sort of tour, wonderful experiment that worked in the long run. We had great time discovering all these new works. They were new in those days. All these pieces that you see in the opera today, Daughters of the Regiment and Semiramides and things like that, they were completely unknown in those days. And we were able to do them. Once Joan sang Lucia at Covent Garden, she suddenly became world famous, as you all know. And so she was able to do what she wanted to do in the theatres because she was guaranteed to fill them. And so she had a little prodding by me, and we managed to discover all sorts of wonderful pieces which she was able to sing. And, of course, this helped greatly in the revival of bel canto music because Maria Callas had really begun it after the war. And she was encouraged by Tullio Serafin, who was a very great conductor and my idol. And he encouraged her to sing Puritani first, and then she did a lot of big, big revivals at the Scala. And then we sort of followed on, and then along came Madame Cavalier, and it caught on. And now everybody wants to sing bel canto, whether they can or not.
Now, there's a good point. How many people do you think can as against the ones who can't? Has that ratio increased over the years?
Oh, I should think about 5% can, maybe.
5%, right. Well, That's something, because it is a particular demand. It is
well,
a particular
the trouble
skill.
Today is that we don't do enough of it. You know, I come to work, for example, to work here, and the young singers are very willing, and some of them are extremely good, and they're lovely people, and they try hard, but they're not used to singing bel canto. They're put on in operas like Bliss and God knows what, and, you know, it doesn't matter whether they sing beautifully or not. They can shout their way through an opera, and that does not amuse me, I can tell you. In fact, I kill them before I let them shout in my operas if I got the chance. But to me, singing is about something beautiful. It must be beautiful. I tell them always, don't sing louder than beautiful. And some of them, they don't really get that message, but I've been pretty lucky in Sonnambula. And last night I was really quite thrilled because Emma Matthews sang a performance which was absolutely adorable and lovely. And so that made my week, I can assure you.
That's something. It's lovely when it all comes together.
Oh, it is. It's a great thrill, yes.
It's good. What about your association with Sonnambula? When did that start? Did that start with Joan or did it start before?
Yes. Well, I knew the piece before, but I did the first one with Joan in San Francisco in 1963. And Lotfi Mansouri was directing it, and Alfredo Kraus was the tenor. Yeah. So it was a good start. And then we've done it all over the place, the Met and Covent Garden and here and there. It's an opera I care about very much. I love it. So I take it as a personal affront when people don't sing it the way I want them to sing it. You know, but so I get affronted sometimes, as you might imagine.
What appeals particularly about Sonnambula, say with other
Well,
Bellini
it's
operas?
It's the great lines of Bellini. Bellini is a fantastic composer to me. I mean, my God is Mozart. But I think after Mozart, you know, Bellini's very high on the list, if not next on the list. He knew how to write for the human voice. He knew how to write melodies which were unforgettable and glorious, long, long lines that would go on forever. And I've done, what, four or five Bellini operas, and I don't know, I can't think of a boring bar in any of them. They're wonderful pieces. It's glorious. And I still am perhaps old-fashioned enough to believe that the public generally go to the opera to hear good singing, not to see some stupid production, which is some wretched man or woman's concept of the opera. That's my unfavourite word at this moment.
I think the coalition's going well. This is... We are in the age, Richard, of Regi Theater, of director's theatre.
Unfortunately.
When you were performing, say, with Joan, whatever, it wasn't as much that, but the directors, although they were extraordinary, people like Zeffirelli or Visconti, whatever, there was still some, I guess, respect there for the music.
Well, they had great respect for the music, for the operas, and they, in many ways, went back to the way they were performed in the 19th century and reproduced that, which they should do, because an opera is a museum piece, the same as a Rembrandt or a Goya or whatever you like to mention. And as I've said many times, you don't go along to a museum and paint over the costumes and bring them up to date or change them. They are as they are, and we have to accept them. If we don't like them, we don't need to go. And I think the opera is the same. You must accept it as it was meant to be. And I hate any fooling around with them. Occasionally it works, but...
Richard, you're winning votes all over the place. This is too good. Your life in music, you were talking about Chopin before and piano and whatever. I asked Joan years ago, I think when she was retiring, that if she hadn't met you, what would she be doing? And she said she'd probably be carting herself off to the Tempe Tip. I can remember the answer. But something bad like that. What do you think you'd be doing if you hadn't met Joan?
That's a good question. I never thought about that. It's been so long. I might have continued with the piano, but I don't think so, because I loved playing piano when I was a teenager, and I was lucky. Goossens was Sir Eugene Goossens was the conservatorium, and he was a wonderful old martinet, and we were terrified of him, but he was wonderful to us, and he helped us a great deal. I was lucky enough. I played the Liszt E flat, if you can believe that, with him, and the Beethoven Fourth too. he was. It was a great, great experience in my life to be associated with him. But it was he who sent me to the opera class in the conservatorium, because the whoever was playing for the opera class was ill that day, and they were doing Marriage of Figaro. Now, I, at 13 or 14 years of age, did not know what the Marriage of Figaro was. Can you believe that? I was really ignorant. But I went along. I had played a lot of Mozart. I think I learned every Mozart sonata, and I played a couple of the concertos. I adored Mozart. So reading Marriage of Figaro was not something that was foreign to me, and I loved it. That really set me on the path. Anyway, I was obviously successful playing for the classes, so they put me in Falstaff, and that was much harder for me to read. I mean, Falstaff is a very, very difficult piece for a young pianist to read, I can tell you. And there was an old violin teacher at the conservatorium called Florent Hoogstuhl. And he was an old terror of the first water. I think his great enjoyment was to make the girls in diploma class get into floods of tears, which he did regularly every week. Well, he didn't get me into floods of tears, but he did say, "F sharp, you stupid pig," which I thought was rather charming. But, so when people tell me I'm tough on them, I say, "Oh, you should have gone back and been around when I was a student."
But I bet you never forgot.
I haven't answered your question. I don't know what I would have done. Who knows? I believe in you. What comes along, you manage with it one way or another. Mm. I'm a Libra.
Because you waited a while before conducting, didn't you?
Well, I fell into conducting. I mean, I didn't really have the intention of being a conductor.
So what happened?
Well, Joan was doing a concert in Rome at the Santa Cecilia, and the conductor, I fell under a taxi or something, and the other one got the flu, and the day before there was nobody to do the concert, or a couple of days before. So my Joan's agent said, "Get in there and conduct the concert." I said, "You're out of your mind." I said, "I have no idea how to conduct a concert." "Of course you have," she said. "You know all the repertoire." So I said, "Oh, well, all right." I was stupid enough to say yes. But it went all right. The orchestras were lovely to me. And I learned my career in public. And I worked with every orchestra that you can think of, including all the orchestras in London, the New York Philharmonic and Chicago, all the big orchestras, Los Angeles Philharmonic. They were all lovely to me. I can't tell you why, but they were. And I was given a very good bit of advice once by Marilyn Horne's husband, who was Henry Lewis, conductor, very good conductor. We were doing a concert. I had a concert. It was my American debut in the Hollywood Bowl. And I was sitting at the swimming pool with Marilyn and Henry. She lived there at the time. And he was talking to me about the program, and I told him what I was doing, Rachmaninoff's Second Concerto, which is quite difficult, let me tell you. He said, "Look," he said, "when you don't know quite what you're doing or what to do," he said, "do nothing. Just look at the orchestra." I thought, what a good piece of advice. I did just that, and the concert went swimmingly. So when in doubt, I do nothing.
Well, it's held you in good stead.
But I do believe in
you
letting...
You must do something.
Oh, of course. But I do believe in letting orchestras and singers have their head when they're good. You know, I can't bear to beat them into a performance. That I don't like to do. If you find somebody that's got great sensitivity, you let them show it and try to help them. I mean, I think the job of a conductor is very much is to make everybody perform as well as they possibly can, and to show off their virtues and to hide their faults.
The other thing that it's not as much a secondary thought with you as with a lot of people who associate you with opera and various things, but ballet, of course, is another central love of your life.
I love the ballet. I have to tell you, I'd rather go to the ballet than the opera any day. Because when I go to the opera, I get irritated or itchy, you know. It's not the way I want it always. But the ballet, perhaps I know less about it, so I like it more. I love going to the ballet. In fact, I'm going to Cuba at the end of this year to conduct a ballet, so I'm looking forward to that.
And that's with Alicia Alonso.
Yes, Alonso was one of the greatest dancers of all time, in my mind, the greatest Giselle that's ever been. And she's now 90, and they're doing a great gala for her at the Metropolitan Opera, which I can't get to. I'm furious about because I have to work. And she is blind. She's totally blind. And she still runs the company. And she's extraordinary. she did a new production 2 years ago of The Sleeping Beauty, and I was talking to her about it. She said, oh, but this is not right, and that's not right, and I'm going to fix this, and I'm going to fix that. And I thought, how the hell do you do that? But she has some instinct, some almost inner power, and she runs that company in the most miraculous way, and it's a wonderful, wonderful ballet company. The Cuban dancers are fantastic. In fact, they're coming here to Brisbane in, I think, September. So if any of you will feel like going, I advise you to go.
With those ballet scores, Richard, you recorded the great Tchaikovsky ones, as we all know, mm-hmm. and how wonderful they are. Maria, I'm sorry to talk about another label, but we'll get on to Melba soon. But there's obviously something in that music that is so special that you certainly seem to bring out, as distinct from doing it as a ballet performance. I mean, it's just the scores you've recorded.
Well, you know, I started going to the ballet in the 40s, to the Borovansky Ballet here, which was very fabulous, and to a young boy discovering ballet. I mean, they came out, a lot of them came out of the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, and they were really good. And then when I went to London in 1950... I discovered festival ballet, and then the Danes came, the French ballets came, and the American ballets came. They all were coming to London because it was the Festival of Britain, so I was exposed to a lot. I was very lucky, and I met Alicia Markova, Dame Alicia Markova. And she was a divine lady. She was really wonderful. And Decca suggested to me that I make a recording of ballet music dedicated to her. Mm. Well, I was very thrilled at the idea, I went to talk to her about it, and we talked about repertoire, and she used to sit down at the tea table and dance all the ballets for me with her fingers on the table. It was extraordinary, and I learned a great deal from her, because she told me that with the great conductors, with Diaghilev, they were taught that they danced to the music, not the music following dancers, sometimes errant dancers. Which makes real sense. But, of course, this is what rehearsal's about, and it's in the opera and in the ballet. You have to rehearse together, and when you rehearse a lot together, you find out what strengths and weaknesses each one has, and you iron them out before you get to the public, hopefully, so that when you get to the public, you don't have to beat them into submission. You're able to make music together. And this is what it's all about in the theatre, whether it's ballet or opera, you're making magic. And if you can't make magic, go and do something else.
Well, I hope you don't. That would be a mistake. You're known to a lot of people as a singer's conductor. I mean, the singers you've worked with, the singers you've actually discovered, trained, bought here, Mr. Pavarotti in 65, all those different things. Has that always been the case, that you've had this extraordinary sort of ability with singers?
As I say, I grew up with them. It was second nature to work with singers, and I actually love the human voice. I mean, I think it's the finest instrument of all when it's a good one and properly produced. But yes, I've been lucky enough to have worked with many, many great singers. I mean, Tebaldi and Caballé and Schwarzkopf. Well, we could name them over and over again. And I've learned from them all. I learned a great deal from my wife, because, you know, we would work every day, practically. And sometimes I'd write, if we're doing a Handel opera or Bellini or something, I'd write a little cadenza of some sort for her, and she'd get it wrong. And then getting it wrong was better than what I'd written. I'd say, well, we'll keep that in, you know. No, she had an incredible instinct. Joan didn't study music very much. She learned piano a bit, and that was all. But the instinct was amazingly strong. And I think instinct is very, very important in life. I follow my instinct, absolutely.
And you still do?
I still do, and I'm going to go on doing it. And if nobody likes it, that's too bad.
Richard, what's left to conduct for you? What are the things you'd really...
Well, I don't want to go very much out of my repertoire. I'd like to do much more Mozart than I do. Mm. There are plenty of Donizetti's, early Verdi's, and a couple of Bellini's I'd still like to do. I'd like to discover more Massenet, more Offenbach, and I love operetta. I would love to do more Kalman and more Lehar. Apart from that, some French 19th century. I don't know. There's plenty to do that I haven't done. Mm. I love Aubert. I love the Irish composers. Balfe and Wallace. Yeah. I adore them. I've just recorded an opera by William Vincent Wallace called Lurline. And it's a wonderful piece. Nobody knows one note of it, as far as I know, but it's worth hearing.
How do these operas fall into, not disrepair, but just into obscurity?
Well, I don't know. It's a matter of fashion, and it's a matter of the theatres are frightened very often. I mean, they're not frightened to put on a modern opera, which amazes me, because half the time they're empty. But they are frightened to put on the great old classic works if they're not known. They'll do Traviata and Tosca's ad nauseam. Well, I shouldn't say ad nauseam, because they're great works and they should be performed all the time, because there's always a new audience for them. Mm. But there are lots of wonderful operas that are never heard, and I can't tell you why. You have to find somebody that really wants to do them and they're in a position to be able to do them, and then sometimes they get done.
Yeah. What about Wagner? It's not your
I love Wagner. I don't want to conduct Wagner. I did a bit. I've done all the pop bits, you know. But when I went to London in 1950, Flagstad was still singing, and I heard her sing Isolde and Parsifal, Kundry, and both the Brunhildes and Sieglinde, and Isolde, I think I said. She was unforgettable. I have never heard anybody in Wagner sing that could approach her, and that includes Birgit Nilsson and all the other people that have done it. She was an amazing singer. She sang without any seeming effort. She could... The sound poured out of her. She didn't seem to be doing anything much on the stage, but it was, she acted with her voice so wonderfully. You were spellbound. And in that period, also, there was Gottlob Frick, who was one of the finest basses I ever heard in my life. Hans Hotter was singing. And there were the Konietzny sisters from Vienna, who are wonderful Wagnerians, both of them. Our own Sylvia Fischer was a pretty good Wagnerian. She was a wonderful Sieglinde. And I went, and my wife sang all the you know, Rhein Maidens and things, Valkyries in the early 50s. So I heard a lot of performances of Wagner all through the 50s. And after that, I've been sometimes, but I'm generally disappointed now. I heard James Morris sing Wotan, and that was pretty splendid. But a lot of the singing to me is a little bit second rate. So if that's people think I'm anti Wagner. I'm not anti Wagner. I'm just anti the singers that sing Wagner.
It'd be wrong, I think, to call you a traditionalist. But you're a person who treats music with respect. Do you think that's probably?
I really do, because I mean, I think, let's face it, Bellini, Verdi, Mozart—they knew a lot more about it than I do, and I wouldn't dare to try and change their view of it. Which I mean, all these young people—they come along, and they're not interested in the composer, they're not interested in the libretto. They want to put their thoughts in front of the public, and that is, of course, ego and nothing else.
It does happen. Have you had the unfortunate sort of clashes?
Oh, I've had my clashes, yes, I can assure you. I'm not always pleasant.
Richard, I don't believe a word of it. But what tell us a memorable clash. You can change the names if you like.
Oh, why? It doesn't worry me. I did a Pericole here. Now, La Pericole is one of my favourite pieces of Offenbach. It's a wonderful piece. When I say, I don't think it came to Melbourne, or did it, I don't remember. Anyway, it was directed by a lady who should be nameless. Well, it was Lindy Hume, and I hated her, you know, what's ever since. They insisted on doing it in English, which I thought was a great mistake, because Offenbach and the French language are bound up together very much, and with surtitles, you don't need to sing it in English. Not only did they sing it in English, they commissioned a new translation. It wasn't in English, it was in Strine, if you don't mind. And it was horrendous, and I fought with her for a month. She also had a whole lot of modern jokes about the royal family and the parliamentarians. It was nauseous, and I've never forgiven her for that.
What about Gilbert and Sullivan?
Love it.
Yeah.
And you know, that's something they do very well out here, because Stuart Maund has done some lovely ones, and I've conducted, Mikado and Iolanthe and Trial by Jury here. I love them. I think they're great fun. And the music is very chic, you know. It's maybe derivative. He's pinched from Auber and from Offenbach and you know who. But it's great, and he pinched wonderfully. After all, most composers pinch a bit, don't they? Even Lloyd Webber.
I always thought Puccini was very naughty to pinch those tunes of Lloyd Webber put into The Girl of the Golden West. But anyway, that's something else. There's a whole world. What about musicals? Are you a fan
of love musicals, especially the old ones. I mean, I saw in the 40s here, the first musicals that came out here after the war. There was Annie Get Your Gun in Oklahoma in about 47, 46, 7, 8, or something like that. And I was bowled over by them. And I always go to the musicals when I get a chance. I find the older musicals are better than the new ones, although there is. So I like Phantom, actually. I think I've seen that 6 times, and I enjoy it very much. But a lot of the modern musicals, the music is a little bit tame, a little bit second rate. Sometimes it's a good story, or a good production, which is nice to see. But if they do any musical revivals of the 30s and 40s, I always go. I love them. And I have a feeling that in the coming centuries, the pieces from this century that will be remembered might be Kiss Me, Kate and My Fair Lady and things like that, as opposed to some of the modern operas.
Could well be, I think. Mm-hmm. Richard, let's go back to the Sutherland Williamson season. We were talking the other night about wonderful Frank Tate and Viola Tate and just that whole thing, because that was such a turning point, I think, for opera in this country.
It was a wonderful time. So Frank came over to Europe, and we sat down by the hour discussing, I won't say fighting, because we never got to blows, but Sir Frank had been part of he was the youngest of the four Williams, Tate brothers, rather, in J.C. Williams, and when the Melbourne Williamson Company was formed. And he said, I started my career that way, and he said, I'd like to finish it with the Sutherland Williamson season. And so we sat down and we started to talk about it, and of course he wanted us to come with Boheme and Butterfly and Tosca, the Surefire Sellers. And we said, no, that's not what we do. And we talked and argued for a long time, and eventually he gave in, which I thought was very noble of him. He was a lovely old man. He really was a marvellous man. And he brought us to Australia. We performed for 14 weeks. We did 8 shows every week. That's matinees, Wednesdays and Saturdays. We never changed the opera once. And we did 7 new performances, 7 new productions. And we brought wonderful singers like Pavarotti and John Alexander and Elizabeth Howard and so many of them. And we had some young Australians. Robert Allman was in the company in those days, way back in 65. It was an amazing time. And, you know, there were no unions around. We rehearsed round the clock. We'd frequently be rehearsing till midnight. Nobody ever complained. Everybody loved it and wanted to do it. The main singers understudied each other. They sang small roles when required. And it was a fantastic opportunity. I don't think it can ever happen again, because nobody would ever afford to put something like that on anymore. It was a great, great experience.
But also, as you say, the repertoire was unusual.
We did La Sonnambula, Last Time to be Heard Here. We did Semiramide, Traviata, there's this one popular opera. Mm. L'Elisa d'Amore, Faust. I'm leaving something out. Lucia.
Did you do
Eugene Onegin? That's about the 7, yeah.
That was an astonishing repertoire. How many of those did you conduct, those productions?
Oh, I conducted Semiramide, Sonnambula, Traviata, Faust, I think. Is that all? I certainly didn't do Onegin, although I read it in the paper the other day that I did, but I didn't. What else? I didn't do L'Elisa d'Amore. We also brought that. I didn't conduct that. I think I conducted the five of them.